Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business, take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic. As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The race is on, and the first of Formula One's much-vaunted sprint qualifying races will be held at Silverstone this weekend. But what impact will the 100km Saturday sprint have on the British Grand Prix as a whole, and will it work as hoped? I'm Ed Stewart, and joining me to answer those questions and more are Mark Hughes and Scott Mitchell. Well, hello Mark, have you recovered from F1's triple header?
Physically I have, although I'm now in prison, imprisoned in my own home, as per the regulations, so that's a bit of a bore. But other than that, yeah, fine.
It's good you clarified you're just in prison in quarantine terms, just in case people thought something strange had happened and we're using visiting hours to get the podcast recorded. But I should say we would still expect you to offer your insight even in that circumstance. So I'm glad we've got that.
Absolutely, yeah. No problem.
We've got the precedent set for that. And hello, Scott Mitchell, not in prison, I hope.
No, although, you know, sometimes when you're stuck in the same place, obviously, for a while, it can feel a little bit like that. But fortunately, I've grown to love the little mini COVID prison I've been in for the last 18 months. I suppose, Ed, you could say I've developed some kind of Stockholm syndrome.
It's been a long time. Eventually, we had to have a Stockholm syndrome pun turning up at some point.
We can edit that out, can't we?
Yeah, well, we normally edit quite a lot of Scott out. People don't realise the podcast normally takes 4 or 5 hours, but we cut it down to kind of 45 minutes an hour once we...
Yeah, we have to try about 50 or 60 of these intros until I stop being either offensive or just plain stupid.
Exactly, yeah. Whereas the rest of us are always perfection at all times. Well, should we talk about the British Grand Prix, Scott? Because there's been endless talk about sprint qualifying over the past few months. Can you lay out the basics of how it's going to work and what actually we should call everything as well?
Yeah, I think for starters, you are probably going to hear it referred to as the sprint over the course of the build-up to the British Grand Prix through the weekend and other events that have this format in place. It was originally, yeah, you've been referring to it as sprint qualifying. That is what it is. It's a qualifying race on the Saturday. But F1, I think, will brand it as the sprint just to sort of keep qualifying as qualifying and, you know, the Grand Prix as the race. So basically, it's something that's going to be held at three events this season, and Silverstone is the first one. It's a format change as well, not just sort of something being crowbarred into the existing weekend structure. So basically, it will feature a normal qualifying will take place on Friday, quite late in the day, and that will set the grid for the sprint race on Saturday. The Saturday sprint race will be 100 kilometres in length. There will be no mandatory pit stop. There's complete freedom of choice on tyres. And it will establish the grid for Sunday's Grand Prix and also award points to the top three finishers in a 3-2-1 system. So you get a little bit more than just pole position for topping it. It's something that we've been expecting for quite some time. As I said, the first one's going to be at Silverstone. It will also be in use at Monza. And there's a third venue that hasn't been confirmed just yet. Brazil was initially earmarked for it, but I think we all don't really expect that race to go ahead. So maybe Austin or something like that. And as I mentioned, the other thing that's important to factor in is it does adjust the wider format as well. So we're going to have a 60-minute FP1, as we do at the moment, with two sets of tyres available. Qualifying will be take place later in the day. Five sets of softs available. So this is something that changes from normal qualifying, whereas in qualifying at the moment, obviously the tyre that you use in Q2 to get through to Q3, that's your starting tyre for the Grand Prix. But now, for normal qualifying in this new format, all the teams will just be using softs, and then they will have freedom of tyre choice for the start of the sprint race and also for the start of Sunday's Grand Prix. On Saturday, obviously, qualifying will have taken place on the Friday, but Saturday we'll have an hour of FP2, obviously, with only one set of tyres available. And then, as I said, the 100-kilometre sprint race later on with two sets of tyres available, but no mandatory pit stop, no need to use two compounds in the race. And then Sunday's Grand Prix takes place as it does at the moment, but with the exception of freedom of choice for the starting tyre. So I think that is pretty much everything you need to know about the sprint race in terms of the broader overview, the weekend structure. But if I've missed anything, Ed, now is your chance to berate me.
No, you expressed it very eloquently and concisely. So we can get Mark to talk a little bit about the impact. What effect will it have? On the one hand, just the one practice session before qualifying. And of course, Sunday's race will be disrupted by what happens in the sprint. But on the other, it's also just a straightforward 100-kilometre race. So does that risk being more of the same, just being a bolt-on extension of the Grand Prix itself?
It's not going to change the competitive order, but the way that we get there might be, you know, there's more room for some random variables to get in the way. The idea is that in the ideal world, it's just this flat-out sprint where the drivers don't need to worry about strategy, and that's the idealized sort of thing that they've been chasing. But I don't think it'll work out like that. I mean, we might get a pleasant surprise, but I suspect it'll be once it settles down from the first lap, I don't think drivers are going to be risking too much, because obviously it's a retirement or a bodywork damaging incident that puts you a long way back is completely screwing your chances for the big event. So you can look at it as just the first stint of the race. Really, I think is probably how it's going to be approached. Let's see. There may be some unintended consequences, negative or positive. And I think it's quite intriguing. I'm quite looking forward to seeing how it does pan out. I don't think we're going to see the idealized sort of flat out. Just it's called the sprint, so it makes you think it's going to be driven flat out. I think you'll still have to do some tire management in it. I think it's still going to be a similar style of racing. It's just the way how we get to Sunday's grid is going to be different.
It's not going to be British touring cars at Brands Indy in race three with a reverse grid, is it? You're not going to have people, trying to wheel bang out the way to make as much ground as possible in a short time. And it's also not going to be anything like the two-lap sprint that we saw at the end of the Azerbaijan Grand Prix, where it was basically, if you were in that midfield fight, it was a free-for-all, basically. Pierre Gasly was willing to risk chucking his AlphaTauri into the wall because he was like, I've got one lap here to get a podium, so why not? It's not going to be anything like that. And you know, Ross Brawn is the biggest champion of this sprint race, is going to bring out the drivers racing mentality argument. I don't really buy it because I do agree on principle that, you know, these racing drivers are going to get competitive in a supermarket car park with some trolleys, but they're not the guys who are actually sort of really in charge of how you approach the full weekend. And they know that there are more points on offer on Sunday than Saturday. So I just think the long game is still going to come into it. In the same way that you see drivers taking a risk into turn one on the first lap, but they don't, it's not a win it or bin it mentality into the first corner. So I don't think that's going to happen. One thing that I am quite intrigued about, because as Mark said, it is quite fascinating to see exactly how it plays out. There's going to be a huge novelty value to the first one, especially. But one thing that I'm intrigued is, I think a few times whenever we've seen, for example, like heavy rain on a Friday and the Friday running is massively reduced, there's always like, and sometimes I think the correlation is real, but it almost inevitably prompts a debate through the weekend of, oh, should we be taking away track time and data from the teams? Because when we don't know what's going on, qualifying's a bit more interesting and the race is more of an unknown. We're going to get a bit of a flavour of that with the sprint format, because we're only going to have this 1 hour of practice on the Friday. And then the cars are going to enter a form of parc fermé for qualifying itself on Friday evening. There are going to be changes that the teams are permitted to make. At the time we're recording this, we don't know the full suite of what's going to be part of parc fermé and what isn't, but there are going to be some setup changes that can be made after Friday, and again, I think after the sprint as well on the Saturday. But they are fundamentally going to be locking in their qualifying setups, and by extension, the vast majority of the race car setup that they're going to be using for the rest of the weekend, with only 60 minutes of running on the Friday. And it seems that there's going to be a very good chance that it's going to have the new type of Pirelli rear tire as well, which, while obviously we're not expecting that to make a fundamental difference, it does inject another small variable into the mix, especially if it is a stiffer rear construction and it allows the teams to run lower pressures again. Who knows what knock-on consequences it's going to have? So I think there's quite a lot of intrigue around that. I don't know how you two see it. These teams have so much simulation power now in terms of arriving at the track and ready to go. But McLaren, for example, have a bit of a trend this season of underwhelming a little bit on the Friday and doing quite a lot of work overnight and then coming out the blocks on Saturday. They're not going to have as big a window to do that. So does that have the potential to catch teams out? Because that's what I'm quite interested to find out.
Yeah, I'd say anything that disrupts that flow of that process of fettling the car has to. They are getting less practice session. Even if you set aside the order of everything, you've got two practice sessions, not three. So that's cutting a third of your practice time from a normal Grand Prix weekend. So that will make a difference. And yeah, the fact that you're going to lock in stuff effectively so quickly, it does mean that it's going to privilege the teams that are the best prepared, that take the least time to sharpen and get the car working well. So that anything I think that takes away some preparation time is a good thing, because it creates kind of a narrower window for all the teams to be in terms of who's hit the ground running well, who perhaps needs to do a little bit more work. So I'm quite interested in that effect. And obviously that's the benefit of trading a pre-practice session effectively for the sprint race on the Saturday, which I think is probably it's certainly a positive, and it's a good thing to have something proper to get your teeth into on a Friday. But certainly teams are going to have to make decisions about how they approach qualifying, and also as a result approach FP1 in a very different way, because that's your qualifying simulation opportunity. So it'll have that kind of backwards effect as well. So I'm quite interested. I mean, Mark, it's very, very difficult to say who it helps and who it'll go against, because they've all got the same reduction, and generally anything that changes things makes life harder for the smaller teams that have less capabilities. But do you have any feel for what the impact might be in specific terms?
Only that if you're looking at the two championship contending teams, if you look at a pattern, both this year and last, you would say that quite often Mercedes doesn't hit the ground running, but sort of hones its car into shape as the weekend goes on. And Red Bull more often you know, or quick straight away. Not quite sure if that's going to carry through, but it may do. It's something to bear in mind. I think the McLaren thing that Scott referenced earlier was, I think that's probably more a deliberate. The way they were in their session, they have a very different program to the teams around them. So you see them underrepresented on Friday usually, and then pop up in qualifying. So obviously, I think they'll just change their program accordingly. But I mean, it's impossible to call really going in, isn't it? It's one of those things that any changes will make sense in hindsight, and will just help build the jigsaw between the teams as we progress through the season.
I think it's the big positive of this format change, because having the kind of homogenous Grand Prix weekends, it does mean teams get very, very good at optimising that. They're very comfortable within it. They know exactly what they're doing when. And sometimes, yes, rain gets in the way, or you lose a Friday, as we did at the Nürburgring last year. But generally, you're on safe ground. But this changes things. And while I'm a little bit disappointed that the addition of the Saturday race is so conservative in terms of the way it's being done, because it is just a 100-kilometre race with not much else change that kind of bolts onto the front of the Grand Prix, I think the fact that it is changing the weekend and disrupting it is a very positive thing. But of course, once they've done it once, and it should happen two more times this year, it'll be doing the same thing again. So interested to see if there's any unexpected consequences in that regard. And of course, there always are surprise consequences. Remember how indignant Ron Dennis was about Renault taking lots of fuel out and getting the pole at Malaysia early on in the fueled qualifying, because it sort of wasn't considered a done thing. But there's perhaps not such an obvious way to exploit that, but there's always things that people don't expect that may have an impact. I guess, Scott, as well, it's interesting for drivers, because if you're, say, a Daniel Ricciardo type or Kimi Raikkonen, the drivers who are underperforming in qualifying, you'll at least think, well, actually, we get two races, two starts to make up some ground. So it perhaps inches the dial a little bit more in favour of your race execution compared to qualifying from an average weekend.
Yeah, that's certainly true. And it also injects just that little extra bit of jeopardy. There's a second race start for everybody to negotiate. So there's another key pinch point to manage in the sprint. And of course, if there is drama through the race, I would imagine that the usual red flag and restart rules would apply. So there is potential for things to mix up in that regard. I just, my underlining concern with it is that because there's such a long way back, if you have a problem on the first corner or in the early stage of the sprint, or especially towards the end of it, I don't see why you'd risk it. I don't see why you'd risk compromising your entire Grand Prix for the sake of gaining, say, one place effectively on the grid. Let's put it into sort of a slightly different context with obviously the existing format. With someone's, let's say the Q3 laps, for example, that we see in qualifying now, you do see drivers tend to take a little bit more risk, especially in that midfield group, say the people that are fighting over, I don't know, P5 to P10, because there's a little bit less to lose, obviously, if you do get it wrong. But that's the difference between maybe gaining one or two places or losing one or two places. It's not the difference between, you know, turning eighth on the grid into seventh or 19th. So I just think when you balance up the risk versus reward of being aggressive in the sprint, my concern is that the risk will comfortably outweigh the reward. Obviously, it's something I would absolutely love to be proven wrong on.
Well, Formula One drivers have a tendency to surprise, should we say, in certain things. I guess it depends who you are, because if you've overachieved in qualifying, it's purely about consolidation. If you're a George Russell type or you're whoever's on pole position, you just want to consolidate that. Whereas if you've underachieved, you'll want to attack and try and make things up. The thing I'm most concerned about is it would be a real shame for the British Grand Prix if, assuming the general pattern we've seen this year is repeated, if you have, say, one of Max Verstappen and Lewis Hamilton's on pole position, and the other one's had something go awry on Saturday, and they're starting down the back, and suddenly you've kind of taken away that dual elements. Admittedly, that can happen on the first lap of a normal Grand Prix, and then you get the same effect, but it would damage the anticipation a little bit. The one thing that interests me, Mark, is that they could have done quite a bit more with the sprint race format. If you say, right, we'll add another race, they could have scrambled the grid in some way. They could have made some changes just to make it less than just sort of a chunk of a race added into Saturday. And would you like to have seen a little bit more? And also, does it mean that Formula One has to be a little careful that if the sprints that are run this year are fairly mundane and straightforward, people don't just write off the idea of having a secondary race for good because the conditions weren't necessarily there to be that disruptive?
I think there's been the research that they did among fans a couple of years ago was that they really didn't like anything which might be construed as artificial. So anything which artificially mixes up the competitive order generally got the thumbs down. So I think reverse grids, although that would have made the sprint a lot more exciting, I think they felt it was introducing too much of an element of artificiality into it. I kind of agree on that, but I would like them to go a little bit further with it in terms of, you know, they're saying it's something where the drivers can just go flat out and without worrying about strategy. I'd like to take that component and say, yeah, okay, absolutely, let's just switch off the telemetry. Let's just switch off the radio communication, apart from safety advice. And let's make it totally a driver-controlled race. I would like to see that. I don't, you know, this is an ideal opportunity to try that out. And on the one hand, a lot of the radio conversations are very popular with the fans because it's giving you an insight in how the races are being run. But on the other, there's something a little bit, I don't know, unsatisfying about hearing a driver guided through how to best run his race rather than leaving it up to him. And I think that's it leads to a very small window of optimization. When everybody's optimizing their individual cars, you're not going to see much variation. And I think if it was left up to the drivers to feel their own way of how to best use the tires, how to, you know, best bring the brakes in, or all these things, I think there would be more variation. I think you would see some interesting facets of that are currently hidden about weaknesses and strengths of the drivers. That's where I'd like to see them, you know, be a bit more adventurous with the sprint.
Some of the things you listed there show how wide the scope can be for the changes you make. It doesn't necessarily have to be a reverse grid. It can be some of those minor tweaks that change things. The thing that does slightly surprise me, Scott, is when Ross Brawn was talking about it, he was advocating the simplicity of it, that it's this flat-out charge. And of course it isn't. It's 100 kilometres. These are still temperature-sensitive tyres that require management. That's just a fact. It's not 60, it's not 12 kilometres around two laps of Baku, is it? It's very, very different in that regard. But they've almost taken out all the complexity that they've added to normal Grand Prix that was introduced to try and liven things up, such as making sure you have to use two different compounds so there's a pit stop. So the pit stop's gone. You haven't got your starting tyre confusion based on Q2. Now, regardless of the fact that rule doesn't really work as intended, it was intended to liven things up. So I just find it a little bit strange that Formula One for years has been introducing these things and then suddenly it's a big virtue to take them all out. And that's the downside, isn't it? It actually says if you strip these things out, you actually can end up with a relatively straightforward race. I obviously hope it isn't, but it could be quite straightforward.
Yeah, I guess it's a good example of how easily things just get baked in and just not assumed to be sacred. No one's saying that, oh, I can't believe we're getting rid of the Q2 starting tyre rule. It's nothing like that. But it is the sort of thing that I think just becomes so baked in that you don't really think about it. And F1 has looked at alternatives in recent years, looked at tweaking the qualifying format to add a Q4, for example, and getting rid of the Q2 tire rule. But it hasn't happened, so it clearly hasn't been a priority. And you need something quite transformative for the format to actually spark a bit of action on stuff like that, because quite clearly it would overcomplicate everything if you did try to keep things like, you know, mandating the use of compounds in the sprint as well. If you wanted to try and keep the Q2 starting time for Sunday's Grand Prix, it would be a little bit overcomplicated. So they've obviously taken this, something that has fundamentally shifted the landscape of the weekend, and said, right, what are the other things that we need to tweak? What are the other things that we're perfectly willing to sacrifice now that any other time we somehow haven't managed to find agreement to do anything about, or there hasn't been a desire to do anything about them? So it shows that there are parts of a Formula One weekend and part of the Formula One rule set that are clearly expendable, or at least considered, you know, potentially expendable. And maybe this weekend we'll get an idea of whether or not it actually makes any difference. I think you're going to need really the full set of sprint races to get anything close to a trend emerging of how certain things have impacted it, because obviously the nature of the circuit and the stresses it's putting on the cars and the tires, for example, are going to have a bigger impact on that sort of thing. But I think, given F1, as you pointed out, it introduced a bunch of this stuff to make the races more interesting, it kind of feels a little bit dishonest to then say that we're getting rid of that because we think this is going to be really interesting. It's like, what's changed between then and now to suddenly mean that we don't need this? I don't think making the race, you know, having a race that's load shorter is really going to fundamentally change that. So curious to see if that actually has any impact, positive or negative. I can't really see how it's going to help.
Well, what's interesting is I'm pro them trying different things for race weekend formats. I don't see there's any reason why every Grand Prix weekend has to be exactly the same. Obviously, three sprint race weekends over three circuits is not a brilliant sample set for drawing conclusions, but it will give you a feel for it. But what's actually going to happen, Scott, in terms of what comes from this? Is it a trial for introduction at all races? Is it a hit and a hope and they'll bin it after 1 year? Is there a halfway house? What follows on?
Well, there's not like an official answer on this at the moment, or a plan that's been formally outlined, at least in public. They'll have definitely discussed it behind closed doors. One thing that Braun's pointed out is that he can see this increasing, or he'd like to see this increasing to maybe six events next year if it is a success. But what they don't want to do is that they don't think it's something that works as a season-long thing. It's just something that could add a little extra to a select few Grand Prix events that are going to benefit from it. I would argue that it's the sort of thing that is going to be very, very track specific. And Braun has sort of hinted at this before. It has to be a format that works or is on a track where it works. For example, would you want to see this sprint format used at Barcelona, for example? Or obviously we don't know what the track changes are going to do, but Abu Dhabi, a race where there is no overtaking anyway, so it would literally just be an extra 100 kilometers of watching the cars go round and round in the same order. I think that would be rubbish, to be honest. But other tracks are a little bit more amenable to better racing without any extra variables like, you know, safety cars or weather interruptions, that sort of thing. So if it does work, let's assume it does work, and we all agree, I think, that adding a little bit of extra to Friday, Saturday, and then keeping the Grand Prix on Sunday is a good thing, then why not increase it and use it at a few more events? I don't think I'd want it to be a full 100% format, and neither does F1. How exactly they're going to judge it, obviously F1 will have its own metrics. They'll be surveying fans, they'll be checking things. You can't judge it on the first weekend, because I mentioned earlier there's going to be such a huge novelty value around this that I think you're going to have you're going to naturally have probably a spike in TV viewers on, especially on the Saturday, to see what happens with the sprint race. And there's going to be loads more people talking about it on social media. So if you're doing, you know, not necessarily surveys on social media, but if you're checking, there's all sorts of analytics you can dig up on Twitter, for example. If you're looking to see how many people tweeted about a certain thing, if you're looking at how many people were talking about F1, that's obviously going to be increased as well, because there's a point of topic to debate. What F1 wants from it is very clear, that they think that TV broadcasters, race promoters are going to benefit massively from having something proper on Friday instead of FP2. And there's going to be something interesting on Saturday to take the place of qualifying, which is obviously the sprint race. So it gives each day of the weekend has a headline act and has a sort of premier event, to use Braun's terminology for it. And the basic logic of that is fine. I completely agree with that. So that's how it works in theory. But it does live and die entirely on whether the sprint race is any good, because there's no point in introducing a format that works on paper if actually the product that you get as a result of it isn't actually any good, because then you're just going to have people criticizing it the first time they see it, and that novelty value won't be repeated. People won't want to watch it again because it was rubbish, and it will just be criticized. And then in that case, F1 says that they won't be introducing it anymore, and they're not going to force it through if it doesn't work. I actually think that even if you're looking at it purely from a cynical point of view and saying this is just a way for F1 and a bunch of its partners to make more money, well, yes, it's a business. That is quite literally the point. And the better the product they make, the more chance they have of actually making money from it. So I think the sort of selfish commercial reasons that F1 has for doing this, the ways to judge that are actually the same way that you and I and Mark and other people who are looking at this from a more traditional point of view are also going to be judging it. So I do think there are going to be sort of some common objectives and common hopes from this. And that means we can probably trust the fact that they're going to judge this properly a little bit more than maybe we might think so, because it's easy to be cynical about this sort of thing.
Yeah, well, broad terms, I'm happy with the extra race. Let's just hope it leads to potentially more experimentation in the future. Now, Mark, one interesting statistical footnote of this is that it has been decreed that pole position is considered to be taken not by the driver fastest in Friday's qualifying session, but by the winner of the sprint, who therefore starts on pole position for Sunday's race. I'm not sure where that decree came from. Presumably Ross Brawn ascended Mount Sinai and got it. But numbers aren't the be-all and end-all. Formula One doesn't exist to generate statistics, but they are fun. And the pole position stat, it's one of the big beasts of F1 statistics, isn't it? So do you think it's the correct interpretation?
No, I don't, actually. I would much prefer that they kept the official pole position slot for whoever went fastest in qualifying, which would, in this case would be Friday. I guess they're trying to, you know, take the emphasis... you know, place the emphasis where they want it in terms of promoting the weekend as a whole. But for me, no, I think pole position means who can lap the car the fastest, not who wins a short sprint race on a Saturday.
Yeah, I must admit, I completely agree with that. I'm not even keen of the cases in the past where people have had penalties that have cost them pole. I'm not talking about technical infringements and disqualifications, but things like, say, Michael Schumacher at Monaco in 2012 when he was fastest in qualifying. He had a 5-place grid penalty carried over from the Spanish Grand Prix for rear-ending Bruno Senna, so he didn't start on pole. Therefore, it was a pole position that never happened. And there's a few of those dotted around. I think Raikkonen's got one in his past, Montoya maybe as well, from memory. So, yeah, it doesn't matter really, but insofar as the pole position statistic is worth anything, it is a measure of single-lap speed, ultimately. So it would be a shame if you end up with Max Verstappen fastest in qualifying, then Lewis Hamilton wins a sprint, and Hamilton's 101st pole isn't really a pole like all the other ones. So a minor point, but one that's always fun to consider. Shall we move on to wider issues at Silverstone, Mark? Christian Horner, he called Silverstone a stronghold for Mercedes. It has won 6 out of 8 Grand Prix held there in the V6 turbo hybrid era and taken every single pole position. That history doesn't count for much, of course. So can we expect Mercedes to be a bigger threat than it was in Austria, at least?
It might be, because it does have some new parts coming, parts that were already been done in the wind tunnel, which just hadn't been manufactured yet in the recent Austria races. Whether their car is intrinsically more suited to this type of track than it was in Austria, I'm not sure, because it used to be that Silverstone was a high downforce, all about high speed downforce, and which car could generate the most high speed downforce would be the quickest. But since the 2017 generation of wide cars and wide tyres, it's become more of a drag. It's about drag levels, because corners like Copse and Maggots are so easily flat out that all the cars can do them flat out. So even a car that's got less high-speed downforce than another car will tend to be quicker through those corners because it's arriving at them quicker and it's staying flat out through them. So you those corners are no longer testing the ultimate high-speed downforce limits of the cars. So it may be that if it's just how efficient your downforce can be, it may turn out to be a Red Bull track, you know, because we've seen already that it can generate very good straight line speed even when carrying less wing than the Mercedes. If that carries through, wherever the optimum downforce level is for each car, it's not going to be the same for each car because they're so different. And however that plays out is going to determine which of them will be quicker. Now, maybe closer than it was in Austria, especially the second Austria, where the Red Bull advantage was very significant. It may level out. I don't know. It really is. I think the battle between those two cars is still, we can't be definitive yet. It looks like the pattern is that as the parts go on to the Red Bull, it pulls further and further away from the Mercedes. But let's just see, because we've just had two races at the same track. So that's skewed the picture a little bit, perhaps. But I'd be very interested to see. And I think if the Red Bull really is faster around Silverstone, then Mercedes has got a very big problem on its hands trying to win this championship.
Is there an argument that this is the sort of track that could allow a, you know, McLaren or Ferrari to get close or pounce? Because last year, I think, was it the first Silverstone one, especially like one of the Silverstones last year, Leclerc was mega because he was able to make that quite aggressive low drag setup from the Ferrari work. Because as you were saying, Mark, you can, as long as you can keep it pinned, it works. And obviously, I think Leclerc was just damn good at hanging on to it, and then he made it work in the slow stuff. And we've seen this year that car is just really good at the slow speed bit. So I was just wondering if that's the sort of package that, you know, you could probably get away with trimming the wings, rely on the car to sort of stick at low speed, and maybe they'll get in the mix. And likewise, the McLaren, which seems to be bloody quick in a straight line and good through fast speed corners, maybe they'll be in the mix as well.
Yeah, could be. I think of the two, probably the McLaren, for the reason that you said, it's straight line speed, very strong. Which is also a big factor, not just as I said earlier, not just down the straights, but because you can carry that through the corner too. So yeah, I'd be looking McLaren as a bit of a dark horse, but it may well close those top four teams right up.
It was an interesting one last year because you did see between the two Silverstones, a lot of people followed that kind of Ferrari direction as they really did realise how much Silverstone had shifted. So a lot of people are onto that. But yeah, it's a very, very different circuit to the one of a few years ago, even though it is literally the same circuit. And that just shows you how much tracks are redefined by the capabilities of the car. But Scott, overall, we've had Red Bull 5 wins on the bounce. So for the sake of the championship battle, do you think it does need a Mercedes win just to re-spark the title fight?
Yeah, I think so, just because it's got to the point now where I think it's the first time this season that both Verstappen and Red Bull have pulled like a full event clear of the others. I think Red Bull's lead is now exactly as much as Mercedes would get from a 1-2 and the bonus point for fastest lap. So I don't want to see... I don't care who wins the championship of the two. I don't care how it goes over the course of the season. What I want to see is the battle continue. And to that end, I wouldn't want to see the gap really get any bigger than it is now, because I think all the while you're around and, you know, in that middle ground between, let's say, one and two races worth of points, there's just less jeopardy involved. And there's less to lose when Verstappen and Hamilton go wheel to wheel. You know, Verstappen can afford to back out a little bit more if Max could ever achieve that kind of mentality, given we know that he loves to be aggressive when he can be. So just a return to sort of how much it ebbed and flowed in the first few races would be fantastic. I'm a bit worried, as Mark said, that this trend is that the Red Bull is starting to edge clear, so I wonder if those days are now properly gone. But that doesn't mean that Merck can't cause problems. And all it would take would be, you know, a Verstappen DNF, and if then Hamilton's able to win, then that points gap is basically eradicated, and then we get back into the ebb and flow because things matter so, so much race to race. I think the triple header was obviously fantastic for Max and for Red Bull, built some serious momentum. I think they also established just the first serious advantage that we've seen so far. I mean, Hamilton did build a little bit of a buffer early on, but not to this extent. And I don't think he ever had in that little run in the first four races. It didn't ever look like, you know, the car was going to, you know, just be totally out of reach for the Red Bull, whereas certainly in Austria, the Red Bull was totally out of reach for the Mercedes. So I do think we need to see a little bit of a shift, and it would be quite ominous, not just for Mercedes, but for the championship fight, if Red Bull rocks up to Silverstone, Max is on pole, but not pole, then wins the sprint race and is on real pole, and then wins the Grand Prix as well.
Yeah, it's I think important not to get too carried away with the situation as it is now, which doesn't look great for Mercedes, but we could be looking at a very different landscape if Hamilton hadn't hit the brake magic button at Baku. If Mercedes got the strategy right at Paul Ricard, that would have been two wins. I don't think anything could have changed what happened at Austria in terms of Red Bull's supremacy. Although, even if Hamilton hadn't had that little bit of aero damage in the left rear corner and finished second in the race, that would be a few extra points. So, yeah, things can move around a lot. And yeah, like you, all I really want to see is it staying close. As long as it's decided at the last corner of the last lap of the last race, which would be quite an achievement at Abu Dhabi if there's literally a passing move there, I'm happy. Let's have a little bit of a look further down the grid, Scott, because one of the interesting intra-team battles this year has been Alpine. It started very well for Esteban Ocon in battling with Fernando Alonso, but it's been hard work for him recently. He wants as many parts as possible changed before Silverstone to troubleshoot the car, non-specific problems there. So do you think he's held back by the car or just struggling to keep up with Alonso?
Well, unless something's gone genuinely wrong in the car, like some kind of problem, something's broken, or, you know, something's just not the way it should be, I don't really see how it can suddenly be being held back by the car, because he's actually looked like the one that was on top of it, and he was showing some great peaks in the first part of the season. So I would have expected that. Obviously, we knew that those first few races, that wasn't really the level of Alonso that we could really expect once he found his feet in F1 again. So To be honest, I did expect a race-sharp Alonso to edge ahead of Ocon over the course of the season. But at this stage, so close to when Ocon was doing so well, I would have expected him to just, you know, at least, you know, edge closer to Ocon, match Ocon, maybe edge a little bit in front. But Ocon's been, you know, so far off and cut such a different figure to Alonso over the last two or three events. I think what Esteban's on something like a four-race pointless streak now, whereas Alonso was one of only a handful of drivers who scored points in every race in the triple header that we just finished. So there's such a big difference now. I can't help but be suspicious that something's happened, unless it is something as simple as, you know, Esteban not quite hooking it all up, let's say, in Azerbaijan and France. And then in Austria, where obviously, I guess, if you had problems in the first weekend, they're probably going to be the same problems you have in the second weekend. So maybe it'd be expected to be the same situation, a little bit like we discussed about Daniel Ricciardo on the last podcast. And maybe Ocon's just sort of got into this mindset where he thinks there's something wrong, so he's sort of driving within himself and driving within a perceived limitation of the car. It's really, really difficult, if not impossible, to decipher from the outside.
Yeah, it's hard to judge. I mean, there have been suggestions that it may be a power unit deficit. His speed trap figures, for the most part, are a little bit down on Alonso, but not monstrously so. He did have that engine problem in Azerbaijan that put him out very, very early. But also, you watch the onboards and you can see a difference in the corner entry phase, and that's critical. And it has a few hints of what we saw with Alonso and Van Dorn at McLaren, when McLaren had a fundamental instability problem, and because Alonso's just so good at adapting. In the corner entry phase, he could live with it, whereas Van Dorn was kind of sitting inside its limitations. And effectively, you just end up with a car that becomes really understeery because you're just not able to rotate it. So I'm really interested to see what happens with Ocon. You kind of want to give him the benefit of the doubt, but at the same time, I've asked him quite a few times about exactly where he suspects the problem with. And he says, well, we can see some things in the data, but he won't point to anything specifically. Time will tell ultimately. But Mark, what do you make of Alonso? He started the season already at a pretty decent level, four or five race weekends maybe needed, but he's been pretty sharp recently, hasn't he? Really, really quick in the second Austria in particular. That first lap in Q1 was stunningly fast, and he'd have been certainly front four rows conservatively if he hadn't been blocked by Vettel in qualifying.
Yeah, absolutely. He's really sort of hit his stride. We saw little glimpses of it sort of late race, the late laps in Portugal earlier in the season, and then it dropped off a bit, didn't it? And then it looked like he was not quite hooking it up for a couple of races. But yeah, last four, he's been looking very, very much like the old Alonso. And he's just happy there, just getting some sort of tune out of a less than great car. And he seems to be loving it. He seems to be absolutely in his element. And that dice he had with Russell in the last laps of the last race, you just saw someone who absolutely is loving what he's doing. I've got the few doubts I had about whether we would see the real Alonso after his time away. They're beginning to evaporate now. I think we're seeing something very close to the real Alonso.
There was a great bit on lap five of the race when Alonso passed Raikkonen into turn three, and then Raikkonen came back at him at turn four. It was basically a little bit like the Norris-Perez battle at turn four, with Kimi on the outside and Alonso on the inside. Very, very similar. But Alonso managed to, at the exit, basically box Raikkonen in to exactly a car's width. Literally, if he'd been an inch to his left, he'd have been in the gravel. And if he'd been an inch to his right, he'd be in contact with Alonso. Just so precisely done. And actually, Raikkonen managed to, just to stay ahead through the following corner in that. But he's so good in battle, Alonso. That's a really good indicator. I think we do see the driver of old days. Perhaps not a surprise, but on and off track, being a bit of a spiky character in terms of making his point off track, which I quite like to see as well.
I was just about to say, it's the off track stuff is where we're also seeing the old Alonso come back, because I feel like he's those early weekends where obviously it wasn't going great for him in terms of performance at times, but it was all very smiles and I'm loving being back. This is much more enjoyable than I thought it would be. I've really missed being away. This is lovely. And then just as he starts to find a little bit of a bit of a performance step and things start to become a little bit bigger for him on track and he's got a little bit more at stake, all of a sudden he's very, very happy pointing out everything that's wrong about Formula One or that people are doing wrong. I feel like it started in Baku, really, very angry in qualifying, wasn't he? Didn't he say that drivers need to stop driving beyond their or their car's abilities? And it's just continued since then. He's taken aim at sort of the officials for being lax. Obviously, do you remember? Obviously, Max got or Red Bull got a little bit of a telling off from the FIA for Verstappen's burnout celebration in the Styrian Grand Prix. And then when they were back in the press conference on the Thursday, the following week, Alonso just sort of piped up because he was alongside Verstappen in the presser and just said, "Well, I think maybe the FIA should care about things like drivers breaking the rules at turn one instead of focusing on things like this." And then obviously he had a moan about people because he got impeded in qualifying. So it's just, brilliant, spiky, fiery Alonso. He's very, very bold on track again. He's bold off track. He's just good box office, isn't he, for Formula One? Just when he's up for it, there are a few characters that F1 benefits from having, like Alonso.
Yeah, I would say to people, you may not be a fan of Alonso, you're not obliged to be, but he's great to have in Formula One, and a very, very fine driver. And I just enjoyed him watching the onboards when the safety car came out and he was moaning about Ricciardo using the runoff at turn one at the start. And he just kept going on about it. And there's a point later on where he just sort of said, under the safety car, he just said, okay, right, I'm just going to overtake everyone before the line at the end of the safety car period because the rules don't matter. So that's all right. And he's just having this sort of chippy, sarcastic conversation with himself and sort of his engineers going, yeah, noted. Yeah, can we sort of think about this? Alonso's doing everything he's meant to be doing, but he's also just being chippy about stuff. And I like that. And do you know what? He very often has a very good point. So I think, Alonso's for the good of Formula One. Well, let's have a look at a slightly sadder story, Mark. Carlos Reutemann, of course, won the British Grand Prix at Silverstone for Ferrari 1978. He passed away last week at the age of 79. No great surprises. It was very clear his health was deteriorating. But always sad to lose such a great driver and such a well-loved character. I never had the pleasure of seeing him race in Formula One, but he was absolutely one of the great Nearly champions, wasn't he?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Reutemann at his best was untouchable, you know, among his peers. When he had an on day, really had an on day, and he would dominate. I did see him race. I saw, in fact, my first Grand Prix. He won. It was the British Grand Prix, 78. Saw him go past Niki Lauda as they tripped over Bruno Giacomelli, lapping him. And yeah, he was enigmatic. He could have his on days and his off days. He never seemed, he was quite a conflicted character. I think I said in the obituary, more the temperament of an artist than a sportsman. He would go very, very, very deep into things. A lot of very deep thought. He had a photographic memory for things like engine numbers and tire codes and gearbox ratios. And he was massively in depth and how he approached it, but he did have this wonderful natural talent. He could just when everything was as he wanted it to be, he was absolutely devastating. And actually, one of the most extraordinary demonstrations of that came after his career. It was in the 1995 Argentinian Grand Prix. Ferrari gave him the 94 car for a few laps. He was 52 years old at this time. He'd been in retirement for 14 years, and he got faster and faster and faster and faster, and he eventually did a time that would have qualified him 11th or 12th for the Grand Prix the following day. And that was, you know, after 14 years away. And also, he's the only guy to have finished on the podium in Grand Prix and World Rally Championship, as far as I know. Fiat gave him a car for the WRC round at Argentina in 1918. He finished third. And later, a few years later, he drove a Peugeot in that rally when he was 43 and finished third again. He was an extraordinary driver, extraordinary performer, but very much a lone wolf. He wasn't part of anyone's crowd. He was just had his own little world almost, really. And he never really found a home. He won races for Brabham, Ferrari, Williams. But he really didn't ever find his home. And I think if someone had ever managed to sort of build a team around him, we might have seen an even greater career. As it was, he had he went into the final round of the 81 championship leading by a point, and set a brilliant pole position, and then finished a lackluster eighth in the race, and Piquet won the title. So that was it, really. That was his one real shot at it, but that's not really a reflection of the caliber of driver he was. He was one of the greats.
Yeah, I think that Vegas race is just it encapsulates it, doesn't it? A driver who came so close to winning the world championship but almost seemed to have talked himself out of it on the day. There was no particular reason, that certainly not a particular reason that stands up to scrutiny for struggling, and he didn't need to do a great deal. So just a very, very good driver. There's an interesting anecdote that Gary Anderson told, actually, on our recent podcast we recorded for members of the Race Members Club, when he said that because this thing you mentioned about that memory for engine numbers, Gary said, because he was at Brabham, he joined Brabham in 73, so Reutemann was one of the drivers then, that they used to sometimes change the engine numbers on the engines just so Carlos felt he had the engine he liked. Apparently he liked number 111 of the DFVs. That was one he enjoyed. And you can imagine Gary taking that sort of course of action when he wasn't hauling the DFVs in and out of transit vans or whatever it was that he did. But I always find drivers like Reutemann fascinating, the ones who were absolutely fantastic. And in terms of the kind of the motor skills and speed and all these things, they're every bit as good as the people who do win the championships and multiple championships. But there's just something in them that isn't there compared to the all-time greats. But sometimes it's the thing that makes them more easy to get on with as people. So Reutemann, a great example of the Nearly men. And I say that entirely as a positive, not as a negative. And yeah, what a a great career he had. Well, thanks very much, Scott Mitchell and Mark Hughes, for your insight and looking ahead to the British Grand Prix. We'll, of course, be back after the race to have a very, very in-depth look at how things get on at Silverstone, and we may well turn up after the sprint as well to have a little bit of a discussion about how things went there. In the meantime, head to therace.com and don't forget the hyphen. Plenty to read there from all of us and the rest of the team at The Race. And Bring Back V10, season 4 of that podcast has just started. If you haven't listened to it before, it tells classic F1 stories, and the latest one is all about Fernando Alonso's first season in F1 with Minardi in 2001. And do also check out our YouTube channel, just search for The Race if video is your thing. Next time you'll hear from us, we'll be at Silverstone. So thanks for listening, and join us for everything you need to know from the British Grand Prix.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.